All right, we pick up in chapter 7 through 9 tonight, and really, we're just going to jump right in, but if you remember, in Isaiah chapter 1 through chapter 12, it's really one block of material, if you would. If you were breaking Isaiah up, and you would look at that, and you'd say, okay, these particular chapters are prophecies about Judah and Jerusalem primarily. And so we're right in the midst of some of that as we're going through chapters 7 through 9 this evening, and we'll finish up this section next week. The chart on the overhead is one that you've seen before in class. This one's got some arrows added to it, and the intent is to try to help us pinpoint where we are time-wise in this chart. King Ahaz is on the throne as we go to chapter 7. And at Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser is there. And we're going to study this evening about how Ahaz is going to reach out to the king of Assyria for assistance, for help. This is the king that he reaches out to. And he's reaching out for help because Syria and Judah have formed an alliance, and they're going to come against... And Israel. I didn't do that right. I apologize. Syria and Israel form an alliance and are going to come against Judah. This isn't going to be the first time, though, that there's going to be an attack upon Israel. And we don't have time to go back and look at some of these other chapters and we find elsewhere in Scripture. We're going to kind of rush through this. But reason, king of Syria, and Pekah, king of Israel, those names should be familiar from tonight's study, formed an alliance and first attacked Judah while Jotham was on the throne. Well, if you remember, Jotham is the king that's just before Ahaz. So they form an alliance. They come against Israel while Jotham's on the throne. And we find that in 2 Kings chapter 15. But then there's a second attack. Another prior invasion. Once Ahaz becomes king, this alliance again comes against Jerusalem. And in that battle, that attack, 2 Chronicles chapter 28, Ahaz was delivered to the king of Syria and a great multitude was taken captive to Damascus. Damascus is the capital of Syria. And then Pekah killed 120,000 in one day, and he took a great multitude captive back to Samaria, the capital of Israel. And Oded the prophet, his counsel was, you need to send these folks back, let them go. And so these captives were later released in Jericho. So there's these prior events that lead up to where we are tonight in Isaiah chapter 7. We don't read of these events in Isaiah, but it's important to kind of see what's been going on. So tonight, we come to chapter 7. Rezah and Pekah go up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but they can't prevail against it, and that is perhaps exactly what's being talked about in 2 Kings chapter 16. So the intent, what was the intent? We're told here, what was their intent when they formed this alliance and they came back against Judah, what was the intent?
They wanted to set up their own.
Yeah. They were tired of dealing with Ahaz. And so they were ready to set up somebody that would,
I got my stuff out of order. I am sorry.
They wanted to set somebody up who would be their puppet and do what they wanted done. Well, let me ask this. Why is that of any significance? Why would that be a concern? In the whole plan and scheme of the Bible, why would that be a problem?
David had to be on
the throne. There you go. The Davidic line would end if that happened, right? So that's why this is important. That's why this is a big deal. Because the Davidic line would have no longer been on the throne. Now, we already talked about Ahaz, who does he turn to for assistance? Assyria. What's ironic about that? Yeah. They're the ones that's going to come bring punishment on them. So, it's important to kind of understand some of these things going forward. Now Ahaz, we already have established Ahaz is not a good king. But I want to remind you of some things about Ahaz as we go forward, because I think it helps as we try to get our arms around his response to some things here in a minute. Over in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, here's what we're told about Ahaz. In the time of his distress, he became yet more faithless to the Lord, this same King Ahaz, for he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus that had defeated him and said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, I will sacrifice to them that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. And Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God and cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God. And he shut up the doors of the house of the Lord, and he made himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. That's the Ahaz that we're dealing with. Make one just like it. Make one just like it. It's exactly right. So this is the king that's on the throne that we're dealing with here. And so let's look at chapter 7, starting in verse 1. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it. But it could not yet mount an attack against it. And when the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of the people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. So they hear that this alliance is reformed, that it's coming against them yet again, and they are scared to death. So Isaiah is sent by God to go visit Ahaz. Where does he find Ahaz? I'm sorry? The aqueduct. Yeah, and look, I make this observation only because one of the commentators that I read suggested, I don't think we're told this here, but suggested that because of the impending attack, like, you know, they would get themselves inside the city and then the invaders would surround them and they'd have to take care of and provide for themselves. And one of the things they wanted to make sure they had was water. And that maybe that's why Ahaz is out there checking the aqueducts, making sure that they're going to be able to try to get some water during this attack. I don't know for sure, but that's where Isaiah is told to go find him. So he finds him there. Who does Isaiah take with him when he goes to his son? Remember, we talked about these two sons earlier. These two sons, their names are going to be very significant. What is the significance of Shear-Jashub's name? A remnant shall return. Well, think of the message that's being carried and the situation that exists here. That name's very significant. What's the message that Isaiah takes to him? I'm sorry? He needs to chill out. Why does he need to chill out? Yeah. Verse 4, and say to him, be quiet, be careful, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands, at the fierce anger of Rezin in Syria and the son of Remaliah. He calls them what? Stumps of firebrands. What's that? Yeah. Yeah, it's not really a fire. I mean, it's really not good for a whole lot at this point. It's already burned up. It's used up. It hasn't much use at this point. So he says, don't be afraid of them. So he encourages them, don't be afraid of them. Because the evil that they've purposed, it's not going to come to pass, he says. Because Syria and Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it. Let us conquer it for ourselves and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand. It will not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. And within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people. So the message is, they don't have the power to accomplish what they think they're going to accomplish. This is not going to happen. Because who's really in control? God is. God is. And so Ahaz, I'm telling you, this is not going to happen. So the implication here is, we'll look at verse 9, is that if he believed, he would be established. Look at verse 9. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the head of Remaliah. And this sentence has just really stuck out to me as I've studied and prepared for this class. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. So the implication is, if your faith is what it ought to be, everything else going to take care of itself. You'll be firm in your defense. You'll be firm in your confidence of God. And all this is going to happen just like you've been told. And so it's important then that Ahaz have this faith, right? So what is then Isaiah's action? What does he then offer to Ahaz to try to make sure that faith is what it ought to be, so that they can stand? What is he offering? A sign. Verse 10. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. Verse 11. Ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven. So think about that. Were there any limitations placed on what Ahaz could ask? Nothing. He could have asked for anything. I think I made a note here. Homer Haley, in his comment, said he could have been an earthquake or lightning, be it something in the sea or in the stellar spaces of the heaven, be it something sensational or something simple, God was going to give it. All you have to do is ask. Remember the point of it, you ask this because we want your faith to be strong so that you can stand. And what's Ahaz's response? Yeah, wrong answer. What did he say? It sounds a little familiar, though. What does he say? Yeah. Because I'm not going to do what? I'm not going to tempt the Lord thy God. Remember hearing that before? Who used that phrase in the New Testament? Jesus did when he was tempted. Well, Ahaz sounds sort of pious now, doesn't he? I'm not going to tempt the Lord my God. Was he really pious? No. It's more what James was alluding to. There just wasn't anything there to build any faith. And so it was either unbelief or arrogance or a combination of the two. But whatever the cause, he rejected. He rejected this offer of a sign. Anything he could have asked.
He must have been
Yes. He obviously wasn't as familiar with God as he ought to have been, was he? He was. And so the Lord then says, well, okay, you're not going to ask for a sign. I'm going to give you a sign. And here's your sign. And he said, here then, O house of David. And notice he's speaking to the house of David, not just, I don't think, just to Ahaz, because he addresses it as the house of David, but this is the response. Hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. So we know that as one of the great prophetic utterings of Isaiah in the book, right? Because it's a prophecy of Jesus, of Emmanuel. It is challenging. And I will tell you, you know, it's a passage that I've looked at, read, and studied before, never to teach a class like this. And I will tell you, I've spent a lot of time with it, and I'm not sure I have a better answer for you than I started with. But we know without doubt that these words are prophetic with regards to the birth of Christ. Without doubt. We're told that, right? I mean, Matthew cites it and says, this is it. We understand that. So the ultimate fulfillment is in the birth of the Messiah. And a lot of folks have a lot of things to say about, well, how could that be assigned to Ahaz when it doesn't happen until 700 years later? Let's talk about that in just a minute. What does Emmanuel mean? God with us. It would be important for Ahaz to understand that God is with them, right? He's tried to get him to have faith so that that would be the case. And I think it's important that we recognize that God's with us. I'll just leave it at that. So let's talk about that for just a moment. And here's where I need you all to help me. But the challenge here is that this is assigned to Ahaz. Well, Ahaz is not around 700 years later to see this happen. How's this impactful to Ahaz? Well, what is he told? I think it's very important here about the time frame of these events that are about to happen. What's the time frame that he tells Ahaz that this is going to happen?
Well, it says 65 years he mentions first.
Okay.
On some literal things that would happen.
Okay.
He illustrates that by saying it's really going to be a short time. When a boy, it'll happen before a boy is old enough to finish.
Yeah, the time frame that he's talking about here is there's a child that hasn't been born yet, and by the time that child eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse evil and choose the good, verse 16, for before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. My understanding is that from the time that these events occur, about 3 years later, these two kingdoms are not existing. And so the time frame in which Isaiah is telling him these things are going to happen, it's a short time frame. And so he does see that these kings who he dreaded would be gone. We noted there in 7 and 2 about the house of David and the plural you that's there. So it's a sign not only to Ahaz, but to all of the Davidic, all of the kings of the Davidic line that would come through. A virgin would conceive and bear a son and call his name Emmanuel. The time was determined by the age of the child when he's able to eat real food, verse 15. Verse 17 continues the thought, says, the Lord will bring upon you and your people such days that have not come since Israel rebelled. He's going to bring the king of Assyria against them. And so, Ahaz ultimately doesn't trust the Lord, but trusts Assyria to bring deliverance to them. And so the sign here is that these two kings that you fear, they're going to be gone. They're not going to exist. There's no need to fear them. Any thoughts or comments about anything we've talked about this so far? There's only one woman in history to whom this language applies, right? You read some folks and they want to say, well, you know, it's a different word, virgin, and it's used differently and this, that, and the other, and we want to... I'm not sure I can go down that path. But when the Bible provides its own commentary and its own answer, that's all we need to understand the fulfillment of this prophecy. Chapter 9, verse 6, we'll get there in a little bit, but it'll talk about, again, another messianic prophecy where it'll say there, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be on his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And so the prophecy, without doubt, is ultimately fulfilled in Christ. So that's right. So the time frame should have been pretty evident to him. This is going to be soon. We'll get into chapter 8 here in just a moment. But this comparison between the prophecy that is made here to Ahaz and then what occurs with Isaiah having this son, Meher Shalal Hashbazaz, that's the only time I'll try to say that tonight. The parallel between the two is striking to me. I'm not sure what to make of all of this, but the parallel is very striking because Isaiah will be told this child that he's going to have by this prophetess, before the boy knows how to cry my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus, Syria, and the spoil of Samaria, Israel, will be carried away before the king of Assyria. Parallel of those two events and the ways that they're said. And unfortunately, we have a chapter 8 break in there. But if it wasn't there and you just kept reading, I think it would be even more striking. So I just leave that with you to think about. And so Matthew, when Matthew quotes Isaiah 7:14 as being fulfilled with the birth of Christ, it was this sign of Emmanuel, that is, God with us. God showing the people that God is with them through this sign. And it's the proof that God keeps His Word. And God comes in the flesh. God with us. He delivers His people. Delivers His people from what? It's not going to be from a couple of nations, is it? He delivers His people from sin. From the oppression of sin. From the death that's brought about by it. So He brings deliverance not only from worldly powers, but spiritual powers and forces of darkness. Satan, if you would. And so Jesus and the fulfillment of this prophecy, it's more than Ahaz or anyone could have imagined or understood at that moment. We talked some when we started Isaiah how there are some prophecies that have dual fulfillments. Some prophecies are pretty specific. It's Christ. This is the fulfillment of it. Not all of them are always that way. But we do know the fulfillment of this prophecy in Isaiah 7. I don't want us to leave here with any doubt of that, because when Matthew says this is the fulfillment, it doesn't get any more clear than that. And so really at this point, Ahaz doesn't have much else to do with this, does he? His fate is sealed. So then, any other thoughts on that before we move forward? So then, starting in verse 17, there's this second prophecy here, if you would, and it has to do with the Egyptians and the Assyrians filling the land with war among each other. So God permits Ahaz now to avoid this invasion that they were fearful of. Verses 18 through 25, though, describe the invasion of Judah and the laying of waste of the land in that day, is the time of the Assyrian invasion. And in that day, Jehovah will call for the fly from Egypt and the bee from Assyria to bring about this devastation. How bad was that coming devastation going to be? It's like a... Yeah, it's like the land's flooded with them, right? They're flooded with these nations. And all of this is the result, or will be the result, of an Assyrian invasion that could have been avoided Ahaz had trusted God instead of man.
Yeah, it's not like he didn't know what God had done for his people.
Right.
When you read all these things, that's what you think about it. You know, how many times does God have to reveal His power and His love for His people and what He can do? Why did he just turn blind eye?
Absolutely. And we marvel at Him and those like Him that do those things. And we have to be very careful ourselves, right? Because the greater gift's been given to us. And we don't need to fall in that same trap.
But each generation of people have to create their own faith. They have to develop it. The others that perceive us, they have to create their faith. God acting in their lives. And we can read about it, and we can be told about it,
All right, so chapter 8, come to chapter 8, verse 1, what's Isaiah told to do? You have to say that name. I'm not saying it again. What's he told to do? Write this name down, right? It's interesting, he calls some folks in to witness this, doesn't he? And he calls these folks in to witness it. And that name means the spoils feeds. I didn't do a very good job on my overhead tonight. I apologize. That should say the prey hastens. Assyria's invasion was going to be swift and it was going to be complete. I think that's what that name has reference to. And so he has a son. And before that child would not be old enough to say mama or daddy before the riches and spoil of Damascus and Syria would be taken by the king of Assyria. We've already noticed that parallel to what was said in chapter 7. So, because the people didn't have allegiance to God, they had allegiance elsewhere, that he allows a Syrian army to come to judge the land. And so he challenges the invading army. To do all they can. It tells them in verses 9 and 10, be broken, you peoples, be shattered, give ear, all you far countries. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Take counsel together, but it will come to nothing. Speak a word, but it will not stand. For God is with us. What's Isaiah told not to do there in verses 11 and 12? Yeah, don't walk in the way of the people and listen to the conspiracies. I'm not sure what all that entails. But don't listen to these things. Don't think like the people. Don't act like the people. This is divine judgment. It's nothing else. Don't listen to anything else. This is divine judgment. However they want to explain it, whatever conspiracy they want to come up with, it's divine judgment.
Verse 12 says, do not fear, for I am with
you. Right. Verse 13, but the Lord of hosts, him you shall honor as holy. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. It's the idea of a reverential type fear of the Lord, but knowing what the Lord will do to them for their unfaithfulness. But there's a confidence in him. Verse 14, and he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a stone of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many shall stumble on it. They shall fall and be broken and shall be snared and taken. So what's he warned them about there in that next section, verses 19 through 22? He warns them that they shouldn't take comfort in or seek help from what? Mediums, wizards, spiritists. He's trying to hold this whole time bring their focus back to where their trust should be, right? And so as we get to the end of chapter 8, it's pretty bleak. Verse 22, and they will look to the earth, but behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. So chapter 8 ends with a gloomy outlook. Chapter 9 is going to begin with the idea that better days are coming. Better days are coming. And he's talking about the days of the Messiah. Those in Zebulun and Naphtali, or Galilee, will see a great light. Lamar, would you turn over there and read that for us? Matthew 4, 12 through 17. James, would you read Luke 1, 10 through 33? Luke 1, 30 through 33, I'm sorry. Lamar, go ahead.
Now when he heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali. So that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali.
So we find Jesus moving to that area, fulfilling this prophecy. James, would you read the Luke 1 passage?
And the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bring forth a son and call his name Jesus. He will be great, he will be called the Son of the Highest. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David. He will reign over the house of Jacob forever.
And so instead of darkness, there will be light. What does Messiah mean?
Anointed
One. The Anointed King. And so in a sense, every king was an Anointed One, in a sense. But the Bible tells us that ultimately a son of David would come who would be known as the Messiah. And it is then that peace would come. Well, think about the situation in the time Isaiah is prophesying. There's not any peace going on then. So understanding, looking forward to this time when this Messiah would come. And when he comes, there won't be any more yoke. There won't be any more beating across their back or their shoulders. There won't be an oppressor who's wielding a rod. They'll walk in the glorious light of freedom, a freedom that came from God's deliverance. That's the prophecy. That's what they're looking forward to. What certainty was there that this was going to be fulfilled? Look at verse 7. What certainty is there that this is going to happen? What's going to perform this? The zeal of the Lord of the hosts. The zeal of the Lord of hosts. So how certain are we going to have this happen? God's zeal is going to make this happen. It can't be changed. It won't be changed. This will be forthcoming. He gets to chapter or verse 8, and he finishes up here, and then he turns away from all this great outlook that lies ahead, this light, this one that's coming, and then he deals with their judgment. And the arrogance, he says, I can do all this right quick. The judgment that's going to come upon these people, there's arrogance. They tell God, basically, bring it on. Bring it on. We'll handle it. Bricks may be knocked down, destroy them, but we're going to make them out of hewn stones. We're just going to rebuild. The sycamores may be cut down, but we're going to replace them with cedars. That's pretty arrogant. We've already talked about the arrogant nature of these people. And Israel's going to be cut off, verses 13 through 17. And the land's going to be described as just being burned up completely there at the end of the chapter. We have rushed through this last section, and I apologize for that. Any questions, comments, thoughts before we finish up this evening?
Yeah, I want to mention real quick, you know, it talks about destroying the head and the tail, or from the head to the tail, over the top to bottom. Notice who's at the bottom. False prophets, for example.
Yeah.
That's a way of saying the lowest element of society. If we ask people today, well, who's the lowest element of society, we get all kinds of answers. There is the spoken of as the false prophets.
Very good. Very good. Anything else?
Chapter 7, verse 9, there's a key takeaway that's still true today when it says, if you're not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all.
Absolutely. Very good. Well, thank you all so much this evening for your help.